Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 649, The Corporate State Revisited. This has been recorded on September 27th of the year 2008. We're going to spend most of this broadcast recapitulating part of Miscellaneous Archive Show M42, available for download on the new improved Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. In light of the recent proposal to bail out some financial institutions and people that are associated with them, this proposal that has been floated by Treasury Secretary Paulson, I thought it might be worth revisiting the corporate state of Benito Mussolini and comparing Mussolini's corporate state with the contemporary American political and economic landscape. From the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, September 23rd of 2008, there's an op-ed column by Sean Olander, a lawyer. It's titled "The End of the Republic," and of Treasury Secretary Paulson's bailout proposal, he writes, "Treasury Secretary Paulson's edict to create a $700 billion fund to buy worthless mortgage securities from agitated wealthy bond investors is nothing short of a final step on the path to the end of the republic. The secretary claims he can only be effective if his decisions are beyond judicial review." Skipping down. "This isn't socialism, it's fascism." That again from the San Francisco Chronicle op-ed page of Tuesday, September 23rd of 2008. And what we're going to do now is to jump back into the archives to February of 1990. I did a program, Miscellaneous Archive Show M42, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, in which I compared the regimes of Ronald Reagan and George Bush I with Mussolini's corporate state. I think it's even more important today. Again, from February of 1990, here are some excerpts of M42.
"First of all, in order to understand the corporate state, let's go right to the horse's mouth, so to speak. We'll go right to the writings of Benito Mussolini, the world's first fascist, the head of the world's first fascist state, and the person who coined the term, the corporate state. We're going to begin here reading from a book called, appropriately enough, The Corporate State. It was authored by Benito Mussolini, published in softcover by Valecchi Publishers, V-A-L-L-E-C-C-H-I. Valecchi Publishers published this in softcover in 1938. On the corporate state, November 14, 1933. Resolution drafted by the head of the Italian government and read by him on November 13, 1933, before the Assembly of the National Council of Corporations on the eve of his important speech. The National Council of Corporations defines corporations as the instrument which, under the aegis of the state, carries out the complete organic and totalitarian regulation of production with a view to the expansion of the wealth, political power, and well-being of the Italian people. The National Council of Corporations declares that the number of corporations to be formed for the main branches of production should, on principle, be adequate to meet the real needs of national economy. The National Council of Corporations establishes that the general staff of each corporation shall include representatives of state administration, of the fascist party, of capital, of labor, and of experts. The National Council of Corporations assigns to the corporations as their specific tasks conciliation, consultation compulsory on problems of major importance, and the promulgation through the National Council of Corporations of laws regulating the economic activities of the country. The National Council of Corporations leaves to the Grand Council of Fascism the decision on the further developments of a constitutional and political order which should result from the effective formation and practical working of the corporations." Now, I'm not going to go into any detail on it, but in a nutshell, what Mussolini meant by corporations was in many ways what we today mean by the term monopoly or trust. Basically, under the aegis of the state, each industry, each field of industrial production was to be grouped under a single state corporation. This for the betterment of the corporations and theoretically, at least, the betterment through the betterment of the corporations of the lifestyle of the average Italian. That did not prove to be the case, but when Mussolini is talking about corporations here, he really means what we mean by trust or monopoly. Each field of industrial production was to be grouped under a single state-managed corporation, this for the benefit of the individual corporations within that given field of production. That is what Mussolini meant by corporation. Now we're going to take a look now at Mussolini's corporate state, how it worked, how it was set up, who it benefited, and in particular, we're going to consider what George Seldes, one of the most important researchers on the history of fascism, what George Seldes has termed a spoils system. Although ostensibly set up to benefit corporations and make things run in a smooth corporate manner, in fact, fascism has generally turned out to be just that, a spoils system. And we're going to take a look at how that spoils system works, and specifically now we're going to take a look at how certain big business interests in Italy backed Mussolini, and how Mussolini, in turn, used his corporate state for the betterment of those particular interests. In a sense, fascism could be thought of, instead of being government of the people, by the people, for the people, it's government of the people, by the fascists, for the corporations. Just how that worked was set forth in excellent fashion by, again, George Seldes, one of the most important researchers in one of the most important people in this field of research, and a man who was in many ways regarded as the godfather of American investigative journalism. In his landmark book, Facts and Fascism, published by In Fact Incorporated in copyright 1943, George Seldes goes into Mussolini's corporate state and who it benefited. And we're going to read now on the Mussolini corporate state from Facts and Fascism by George Seldes, again, hardcover edition, In Fact Incorporated, 1943 is a copyright date. And in a chapter entitled Big Business Bossed Mussolini, we're going to begin with our examination of some of the specifics of Mussolini's corporate state and who it benefited. Seldes writes as follows. The first modern fascist regime is the Italian. Fascism itself is as old as history, and although Mussolini is a colossal liar, he told the truth for once when he defined fascism as reaction. Who put up the money for Mussolini? Why did they invest in fascism? How were they repaid? And who footed the bill? The original fascist party of Italy, likewise the Nazi party which was formed almost at the same time, was subsidized by a handful of the richest industrialists and landlords who wanted to preserve their wealth and power and prevent the majority of people from living a better life. The American Legion was organized for the same reason, to preserve the privileges of the few and fool the millions who believed better things would come after victory. Here is the complete list of main subsidizers of Mussolini's fascism, compiled from fascist, neutral, and anti-fascist sources, including Prezzolini, Salvemini, Bonito, and Professor Robert A. Brady and their American equivalents. By the way, interrupting the narrative here, as I proceed through George Seldes' works, not only Facts and Fascism, but Can These Things Be, and his landmark biography of Mussolini called Sawdust Caesar, some of the journalistic references and some of the references here won't be immediately clear. Most of these books are, this book was in the early 1940s. The others date from the early 1930s. So I'm not going to take the time here to explain all of these references to listeners. It would just take too much time. So I'm just going to roll through the narrative and hit the main points. Not all of this is necessarily going to be clear, in particular who many of these people are. Once again, here is the complete list of main subsidizers of Mussolini's fascism, compiled from fascist, neutral, and anti-fascist sources, including Prezzolini, Salvemini, Bonito, and Professor Robert A. Brady, and their American equivalents. 1. The Lega Industriale of Turin. The American equivalent is the Associated Industries of Cleveland, also Associated Industries of Florida, Massachusetts, Missouri, New York, and Utah. Anti-labor organizations, corruptors of the free press, employers of spies, racketeers and murderers as strikebreakers, users of poison gas, all exposed by the La Follette Committee. The La Follette Committee, by the way, was a congressional committee that was looking into the fascistic anti-labor practices of certain major American employers. 2. The next backer of Mussolini's Italy here, of Mussolini's corporate state, I should say. The Confederazione Generale dell'Industria. The nearest equivalent is the National Association of Manufacturers, which has some 8,000 members, but which is run by a small group of men, including the DuPonts, who have subsidized the worst native fascist outfits in America. The National Association of Manufacturers works, quote, in secrecy and by deceit, unquote, according to the final La Follette report, employs prostitute college professors, prostitute preachers, and prostitute journalists. Mussolini is the most famous prostitute journalist of our time. He sold out to the French government for 50,000 francs a month. Documentation in Sawdust Caesar. And the third of the interests behind Mussolini, the Associazione Fra Industriali Metallurgici Meccanici ed Affini. Similar to the Iron and Steel Institute, operated by our steel barons, including Weir and Girdler, one of whom employed the columnist George E. Sikulski, the other the idol of Westbrook Pegler. Fiat Automobile Works. Similar to General Motors, largest stockholder of which is the DuPonts, which is also the largest subsidizer of most native fascist organizations. 5. the Società Ansaldo Shipbuilders, Fiumi Oil Corporation, Venezia Giulia Steel Furnaces, the Upper Italy Hydroelectric Works, and other big outfits, equivalents in National Association of Manufacturers, leadership. The Antinazionale per la Industria Turistici and Grandi Alberghi Associations. No equivalents in the U.S., these being the Tourist Bureau and the Hotel Keepers Association, both more interested in having the trains run on time than the trainmen eating on time or at all. 7. The Landowners Association, chairmaned by Senator Titoni. U.S. equivalent, Associated Farmers. The Italian outfit consists of feudal landlords, the super wealthy of the nation, and is the cause of poverty and starvation among the farming population of Italy. The U.S. outfit includes the packers and canners who control the farm bloc in Congress, constitute the farm lobby, and are, in reality, manufacturers of food and the enemies of the homestead farmer. 8. Banca Commerciale of Milan, Banca Italiana di Scanto, and other leading banks, the equivalent of the Chase, National City, Guarantee Trust, and other banks which have spread dollar imperialism in Mexico, Cuba, and the rest of Latin America. As early as 1923, the fascist Prezzolini wrote, quote, "During the days of the coup d'etat, Mussolini's hotel was literally besieged by the most notorious speculators of northern Italy. The Confederazione Generale dell'Industria published a communique in which it claimed to have played an active part in the solution of the crisis. The Peroni brothers, formerly heads of the Ansaldo Company and of the Banca Italiana di Scanto, who had dropped out of sight after the panic of 1921, have come to life again," unquote. Italia reported November 1, 1931, that the subsidizers of fascism included the brothers Peroni, Pogliani, Borletti, Odero, and Mazzotti of Fondi Ricci and the Esatto Auto Works. Borletti, a textile manufacturer and owner of the Rinascenzi department store, also subsidized D'Annunzio in the Fiumi adventure. Concludes Italia, quote, "In 1931, among the richest men in Italy were the fascists who had had the good sense to put considerable money in foreign issues or send them abroad, notably C. Volpe, Arnaldo Mussolini, M. Ciano, Balbo, and Beneduce," unquote. Bolito reported in the Manchester Guardian and New York World in the early 1920s that when De Vecchi burned the liberal newspaper Avanti in Rome, quote, "This, for the first time, gave the fascists general press notice and attracted the attention of great capitalist bodies, the Lega Industriale, Associazione Fra Industriali, the Confederazione Generale dell'Industria. This latter body openly, the rest credibly, have continued to be the biggest subscribers to fascist funds. Those shrewd fellows of the Confederazione dell'Industria, the factory owners' organization of Milan, whose generosity is visible, though discreet, at every stage of fascism's progress through Beni and Gino Olivetti, managed to induce Mussolini and the fascist Grand Council to accept 25 million lira for the purpose of the party in its conquest of the South. Mussolini was subsidized by the Italian equivalent of our National Association of Manufacturers and similar big money outfits shortly after the seizure of the factories in 1920. In March 1919, fascist agitators caused the workers to seize the Franchi Gregorini plant. Mussolini called this, quote, "a creative strike," unquote, because the workers intended to run the plant for their own benefit. One of Mussolini's colleagues wrote, quote, "at Dalmine he was the Lenin of Italy," unquote. At this time, Mussolini was trying to get back into the labor movement. Interrupting briefly here, Mussolini originally was a socialist, at least to hear him tell it. He basically was a prostitute. He, in essence, went to the highest bidder. He first tried to sell his totalitarian political philosophy to the labor movement, and because they were unwilling to endorse the fundamentally anti-democratic aspect of it, he wound up literally selling out to big business, whereas he had been trying to move his agenda to the labor movement only a few days before. Again, continuing here. When the factories of Milan and Turin were occupied by the workers, Mussolini held a press conference with Bruno Buat, When the factories of Milan and Turin were occupied by the workers, Mussolini held a conference with Bruno Buazzi, who then held a place equivalent to that of Sam Gompers in our American Federation of Labor. He proposed using the money, he proposed using the factory occupation as the beginning of a military movement to seize Rome and establish a dictatorship of the proletariat. Buazzi indignantly kicked Mussolini out. Labor believed in the democratic political processes, and the main proof was that not an act of violence marked the factory seizures, although the press of the world for a month ran daily lies of bloodshed and terrorism. Within a few days, Mussolini had sold the same idea to the owners of the occupied factories, only this time the same blackshirts were to be used to create a dictatorship of big business rather than of workers. Signor Agnelli, head of Fiat, admitted to Buazzi that Mussolini actually had dealt with Olivetti of the Confederazione dell'Industria while dealing with Buazzi. this document in Chapter 8 of Sawdust Caesar. Olivetti and Company put up the money. Mussolini took Rome. And in payment to the subsidizers, his first important act was the abolition of all labor unions, the equivalent of our AF of LCIO and Railroad Brotherhoods. From the day he became dictator, Mussolini began paying back the men who paid him in 1920. He abolished the tax on inheritance, for example, because it was supposed to end big fortunes, and that, of course, meant loss of money for the rich, who had in a body gone over to fascism after 1922.
One of the most important chapters in the history of fascist Italy was the murder of socialist deputy Giacomo Matteotti, and that is what we're going to pick up with next.
Now we're going to take a look at specifically what it was that Matteotti had to reveal, and we're going to take a look at some of Matteotti's specific data. Now, in observing how Matteotti helped expose the fraudulent aspects of Mussolini's corporate state, whereas the corporate state was being represented as something which was going to benefit society as a whole. In fact, it merely benefited almost exclusively benefited the main corporate backers of Mussolini's March on Rome in 1922. Giacomo Matteotti exposed that and was killed for his trouble. Resuming again with George Seldes' narrative in Facts and Fascism, repeating part of the narrative from the previous passage, the reason Matteotti had to die was because he committed the one unforgivable crime in a fascist nation. One more time. The fascist Matteotti had to die because he committed the one unforgivable crime in a fascist nation. He exposed the prophets in fascism. There is no program, no policy, no ideology, and certainly no philosophy back of fascism as there is back of almost every other form of government. It is nothing but a spoil system. Skipping down. It was Matteotti who discovered in 1924 that Mussolini, who had marched to Rome in a Pullman sleeper in 1922, was beginning to pay back the secret forces which had paid the money to put fascism in power in the first place. On May 27th, a few days before he was kidnapped and assassinated by Mussolini's gangsters and family friends, Matteotti denounced in the Italian Parliament a law which would have given a monopoly in oil to the Sinclair firm, the same corporation run by Harry Sinclair, which was involved in the filthy muck of the Teapot Dome scandal, and, incidentally, the same Harry Sinclair who told Dorothy Thompson that he and his associates put up most of the money to buy the presidency of the United States every 4 years. On June 10th, 1924, when the entire front pages of the American press were given over to the Loeb-Leopold case in Chicago, Matteotti was killed by Mussolini's own orders and not a line appeared in most newspapers. On the 16th, Arnaldo, brother of the Duce, printed a warning in his Popolo d'Italia against public clamor for an investigation of the murder, saying such a request was in reality a demand that Mussolini abdicate. But the London Daily Herald told the truth. Matteotti, having challenged the Sinclair oil deal, had prepared a documentary exposé proving that Balbo, Grandi, Arnaldo Mussolini himself, and the biggest men in the fascist government had been engaged in a tremendous graft and corruption deal in relation to the oil monopoly. For all this, the Undersecretary of Home Affairs, Finzi, F-I-N-Z-I, was made the scapegoat. The evidence was plain that he was among the grafters, and as he was also one of the big financial profiteers of a fascist law legalizing gambling, he resigned in an uproar. In apology, the Roman press said that, quote, thousands of jailbirds have joined the fascist party since the March on Rome, unquote, and that Finzi was not a good party member. Finzi was a small shot. Matteotti was using the Sinclair oil graft scandal to hit at the big shots, and the fascists were throwing Finzi to the mob to save the real profiteers of the system. Matteotti had prepared a documentation which showed that the big bankers, the great industrial baronies such as Ansaldo, the great landowners, and the war profiteers who had made billions while Italy hungered were to be given the wealth of Italy. Here is a small part of Matteotti's documentation. And note here, as we go through Matteotti's documentation of Mussolini's corporate state as a spoil system, as Seldes calls it, for the top industrialists and financiers, it's worth taking note of how many of the better-known names from Italian business here crop up in connection with Mussolini. Many names that are familiar to contemporary Americans figure prominently in the history of Italian fascism. Ansaldo, here is a small part of Matteotti's documentation. Ansaldo, a decree law of June 14, 1923, supplied national funds for refloating this private corporation, whose owners had been chiefly responsible for the bankruptcy of the Banca di Sconto. The fascist regime, with 72 million lira against 78 million lira worth of shares given the creditors, became almost half owner. It also took a mortgage for 41,500,000 lira. Fascism subsidized the Ansaldo Shipbuilding Company at 900 lira a ton. It gave Ansaldo 230 locomotives for repair without accepting competitive bids. Fiume Mineral Oil Refining Company. On April 29, 1923, the fascist state purchased 18,000 shares of this corporation for 8,300,443 lira. It made itself party to the success of this private firm. Among the new directors the state put on the governing board were three of the fascists of the first hour, unquote, Dino Grandi, Massimo Rocca, and Eugenio Magrini. Banking houses. The Banco di Roma was in the same straits as the Scanto. When the latter failed, it appealed to Mussolini as a friend and subsidizer of the fascist movement, and Musso the Duce repaid the directors by bypassing the old law requiring them to make good the bank's losses. One of the men who profited most was a certain Senator Marconi, member of the board of the Scanto, who suddenly joined the fascist party in October of 1923. In November, Mariotti showed, he was relieved of the financial burden of putting up his fortune to repay the poor devils who had trusted the Scanto and lost all their money. This is, of course, the same Marconi who claimed he had invented the radio, a claim disputed by several. That Marconi made a fortune in wireless is beyond dispute. Interrupting briefly, of course, the Marconi name in Italian electronics, one of the best-known names, and it's worth noting here that he's also one of the primary backers of and beneficiaries of fascism, and that in turn he was enabled by the fascist state to escape the consequences of some bank failures which he had been party to. Similar in certain respects, again, not an exact analogy, but similar in certain respects to what we see going on with the SNLs today here in February of 1990. Continuing with George Seldes' account. War profiteers. Every nation had a war profiteering scandal after 1918. Mussolini, in his demagogic orations in which he promised everything to everybody, said that he would take back every cent the profiteers made. At the very time he was saying this, Mussolini, as Matteotti later revealed, was accepting big money from the very same profiteers for organizing his black shirts and outfitting them with clubs and revolvers. The various regimes before October 1922 had begun the investigation of the war profiteering frauds, and several suits resulted in large sums being regained. Mussolini had denounced these suits as slow, the sums returned as small. He promised quick suits and complete confiscation of all the property of the war profiteers. On November 19, 1922, less than a month after he took office, Mussolini, with a sweep of his pen, wrote Decree No. 1487, which abolished the Committee of Inquiry into War Profiteering, and the crooks who paid for his election were relieved of all worry. The Società Italiana per le FS del Mediterraneo, a private whale railway line, was granted treasury bonds up to 100 million lira by Decree 1386 of June 17, 1923. A concession for the construction of 800 kilometers of Sicilian railroads was granted two important fascist industrialists, Nicolini and Romano. The cost of the work was to be about a billion lira, and no government returns, rights, or privileges were asked. It was purely a big payoff to early subsidizers of fascism. And still later, talking about a Fortune magazine article both praising fascism and further documenting the enormous profits made by Mussolini's backers, Seldes writes, in its July 1934 issue, A Song of Praise for Fascism, Fortune magazine, owned by Henry Luce, a Morgan partner, and other powerful and wealthy Americans, told of the great corporations and how they progressed under Mussolini. Montecatini, for example, was listed as having assets of $77 million. It consumes 10% of the nation's electricity. It is managed by Gino Donagani with funds from the Banca Commerciale Italiana. Donagani is a, quote, fascist from the very beginning, unquote. Montecatini owns 51% of Acna Chemical Company, and IG Farben, the Hitler cartel, the other 49%. Senior Giovanni Agnelli, manager of Fiat, is, quote, one of the financial backers of the March on Rome. He stands high in fascist councils and has been a senator since the year one of fascism. He owns La Stampa, the leading Turin newspaper. Riccardo Gualino of Snia Viscosa occupies the same place in fascism for money history as the bankers and industrialists who first backed Hitler and whom Hitler later purged. But Fortune, in 1934, reported, quote, along with Agnelli of Fiat and several other big capitalists, Gualino helped finance the March on Rome and in the early years of fascism flourished mightily, unquote. He went to jail later along with other fascist notables who resorted to common swindling in addition to the legal fascist way of draining the nation of its wealth. Martini and Rossi, the vermouth and cocktail lords, is run by Count Napoleon Rossi di Montalara, a member of the fascist party. Fratello Alberto and Pietro Pirelli own a $10 million company which in 1933 made a net profit of $1,500,000 thanks to Mussolini's help. Of course, Pirelli's own a very famous tire manufacturer. Bear in mind that we're talking about the 1930s and 40s here. $1 million was worth a whole lot more then than it is now. Continuing with Seldes' account. The Pirellis control 39 joint stock companies with a capital of 7,818 million lira. Agnelli controls 32 such corporations with a capital of 1,890 million lira. Senator Ettore Conti, president of the Banca Commerciale, the bank once headed by Giuseppe Toeplitz, T-O-E-P-L-I-T-Z, one of the many fascist Jews who supported Mussolini and who was treasurer and cashier for fascism, controls 18 firms with a capital of 3,474 million lira. The significant facts to hang on to, concluded Fortune, are these. If you were an early fascist or contributed generously to the March on Rome, you were likely to enjoy the business benefits that accrue to a high position within the fascist party. Curiously enough, Fortune and Luce's other publications, Time and Life, which had a long record before Pearl Harbor of applauding fascism, will not even now print any news which would in any way indicate that there is at least a slight resemblance between the former object of their affection and the constant love of their lives, the American big business equivalent of the fascist industrial system. And on the page opposite to that, Seldes has reprinted a headline from the New York Times of October 28, 1934. And this is going to begin to develop a theme that we're going to see throughout the rest of the broadcast this evening. We're going to take a look at just exactly how the American mainstream press not only covered for Mussolini's corporate state, but in particular how they also, in so doing, covered for the American financial institutions, the American corporate interests, which floated so many of the Italian bond issues, thereby placing Italy in debt to the United States. And in essence, Mussolini did, in a way, what the Reagan-Bush administrations have done. They have basically mortgaged the country to foreign capital. The New York Times on October 28th of 1934, however, reported the situation in Mussolini's Italy as following. This is the headline. The New York Times, they have the New York Times logo there. Benefits of fascism viewed on birthday. In 13 years, regime regarded as having accomplished many laudable things in Italy. Now, this is October 28th, 1934, and we're going to take note during the rest of the broadcast about just how poorly Italy was doing at this time, the New York Times disclaimer to the contrary notwithstanding. By way of indicating just what kind of favor Mussolini was held in the United States, I'm going to recount here a detail which is included in the context, or included in the text, I should say, of the first Radio Free America show, Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 1. Reading again from Facts and Fascism by George Seldes, in 1935, Colonel William E. Easterwood, National Vice Commander of the American Legion, invited Mussolini to the Chicago Convention, made the Duce an honorary member of the American Legion, and pinned a button on him. Since the Legion has no honorary members, this action was later declared unconstitutional. So although later it was declared as being unconstitutional, according to the American Legion Charter, Il Duce in 35 was named an honorary member of the American Legion. Now, obviously, one of the major reasons why the American Legion, which generally, at least at this period in history, was doing the bidding of the National Association of Manufacturers and major corporate interests, one of the reasons why the corporate state of Mussolini appealed to them was for the tremendous profits to be derived under that kind of a system.
You've been listening to some excerpts of Miscellaneous Archive Show M42, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. The entire broadcast is available for download for free, www.spitfirelist.com. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 649, The Corporate State Revisited. This has been recorded on September 27th of the year 2008. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.